Cliff Central is turning one, and to celebrate, we're giving away R500,000 in smartphones. R500,000 in smartphones. You could win just by listening to Cliff Central on WeChat every day during every show.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
If you want an upgrade or you need a new smartphone, we'll hook you up. Win with Cliff Central and WeChat for the month of April and visit cliffcentral.com for details. T's and C's apply.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon, it's 1.04 p.m. and you're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Kingsley Kipuri and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today I'm joined in studio by Daily Maverick reporter Greg Nicholson and Daily Maverick contributor Gashwell Brooks. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us, Kingsley.
Good. Welcome back, man. Today we have such a packed show lined up. We'll be talking about the xenophobic attacks. We'll be talking about the DA post Helen Ziller and even running up with Hillary Clinton, who's announced she's running for president. But before we get into that, I want to talk about briefly something that happened last Friday. We had the 22nd anniversary of the assassination of Chris Hani. That's a true struggle hero. That's former leader of the SACP, the Communist Party, and chief of staff of Umkhonto Sizwe MK, the armed wing of the ANC. Greg, we talked briefly about this on the weekend, and you mentioned that you find there's often something that's a bit lacking whenever we talk about some of the struggle heroes, especially those that have since passed.
Yeah, I think, Kingsley, we're talking about how often these days we venerate our leaders and we really talk about, you know, Chris Hani and Sisulu, your Tambos, even your Robert Sobukwes, your Steve Bikers, these great struggle heroes past who really made a huge contribution to the struggle and to getting South African society to where it is today and to creating a democracy. But what we often don't do is we don't talk about who these people are. So for younger guys like you and myself and maybe even Gashwell, it's often we don't really understand who these people are and what they were like. So what we wanted to do today was to get someone on the line and to just ask about who was Chris Hani, what was he like in person, what was his character like, did he have a sense of humor, was he just an intense revolutionary?
Yeah.
Well, what was it like actually meeting him, spending time with him before the days of his death?
I mean, you're right. I think sometimes there's a big gap between some people that we hold on such a high pedestal and those of us who are here today. Anyway, you're right. Let's talk to somebody who actually knew him. We'll be talking to General Bantu Kholomisa, a member of parliament and president of UDM. General, are you here? Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming on. Could you tell us a bit about how you first met Chris Hani?
Well, the first time I met him was in 1990 when he came back from exile. Other than that, we communicated as early as 1988 through underground structures in Transkei.
Continue, General.
Go ahead.
Sorry, General. That first time when you met him, was that when the Transkei offered him sort of a place to stay, when obviously the apartheid government wasn't willing to let him stay in South Africa anymore? And can you tell us what it was like actually that first time when you met him? What happened when you met him and how did it feel? And what did you two talk about, you know?
Well, the first time I met him, it was long before his indemnity was questioned by apartheid government.
Mm.
So I remember this particular evening, he arrived accompanied by Paulo Jordan and a late Steve Chwete. We met at Nkululekweni, one of the government houses in Mthatha. And, of course, we met for the first time, and he was thankful for what we have been doing in the region. And very fit person, articulate himself well, and I would say what I saw is what I was told about what kind of a person he was. And later on, he helped us a lot in Transkei to brief my cabinet about what was the plan for the ANC by getting involved in negotiations. We also arranged meetings for him to address kings and chiefs and many communities in the region. Obviously, he came back again when chips were down. That is when de Klerk wanted to arrest him. On this particular incident, if my memory serves me correct, I was called by Mr. Mandela, and then I flew to Johannesburg, and then from when I arrived in his house in Soweto, he whisked me away from there to see Mr. Sisulu, and then he told me on the way that de Klerk wants to arrest Chris Sane and he doesn't want to renew his indemnity. And then we met Mr. Sisulu, three of us, and then I suggested to them, well, why don't we take Chris to Transkei to avoid an embarrassment? And of course, Sisulu and Madiba were saying, will de Klerk not go to Transkei? I said, well, if he wants to arrest Chris Sane, he would have to apply for an extradition treaty. I use the current extradition treaty between the two countries, Transkei and South Africa then.
Mm.
I remember Mr. Sisulu was asking to Madiba, what is this extra? Madiba in his voice, well, Kamela, extradition means that if they want to arrest Christian, they must file in their court here in Johannesburg. I think there's merit in what Bantu is suggesting. So on that evening, same day, so the bodyguards which accompanied me to Johannesburg had to hire cars and took Chris Sane in the evening. The following day he was in Umtata. So he stayed in Umtata for some weeks there or a month, I'm not sure. But when Big Botha heard that Chris was in Transkei, he was the one who called. And he said, my friend, my president is very, very angry. I said, about what? And then he said, Chris Sane narrated that story. I said, but you know it better. If you have got complaints against Chris Sane, file extradition papers in your court. Let your court go and argue there. And then we will serve Chris Sane on this side, to go to our courts to go and argue and oppose that. Then the judgment will be given. And then that's how we scuppered that approach of theirs, because a few days after that, Madiba and Joe Slovo went to see the government or had a meeting with de Klerk and so on. And then that's how Chris then returned back to Johannesburg.
And General, can you tell us, after so long outside of the country, how do you think that Chris Sane was adjusting to returning? Was it hard for him?
Come again?
Chris Sane spent a long, long time in exile, and when he came back to the country, how do you think he was adjusting? Was it hard for him to adjust to being back to South Africa?
Chris Sane, like all other people from exile, I think they acquitted themselves when they came back. They adjusted quickly because the reception in every corner where they went was good. They were well received by the people. I think they took strength and warmth from the fact that they were regarded as heroes. And, of course, it was not easy for him in particular in Madiba, because de Klerk at one stage says they cannot negotiate while they are talking about arms struggle. Mm. So that's why Madiba then and his team suspended the issue of arms. And then remember also on that day, it was during this period which when Chris was still in Transkei, it was tough when the news were broke to him, but he had to accept the reality because they had accepted O.R. Tambo's advice that let there be peace and use the peace approach, which will culminate in negotiations. You are aware about the Harare declarations and so on. So I would say Chris accepted that. If he didn't accept, he would have not risked himself to come inside the country with senior members of Umkhonto weSizwe. And when this request from Madiba that there must be a suspension of armed struggle, Chris had to hold meetings in Transkei with senior members of Umkhonto weSizwe, who had already came between period 88, 89, 90, but we housed them in Transkei. So it was tough for him, but because of his leadership skill, he managed to convince the members of Umkhonto weSizwe to accept the reality.
And General, we often talk these days about Hani's revolutionary spirit and commitment to the struggle, but was there also a lighter side to Chris Hani? Did he like to make jokes?
Chris Hani had a good sense of humor. Remember, in 1991 or 92, we spent 3 weeks together almost every day in India.
In India?
Yes. We flew to India. We went there to request the Indian government to train the members of Umkhonto weSizwe and members of Transkei Defense Force. So Chris and I led that delegation. We stayed there for 3 weeks, and then he came back and reported to Madiba and the ANC leadership. And the following month, we sent officers to India for military training. Some of those officers now are generals and senior officers in the SANDF. And Chris, when he took the podium addressing the senior officers of India, he went to town, not even carrying a piece of paper, but he knew the history of South Africa, India, and the relationship which was existing between ANC and Indian Congress Party. And but all I'm trying to say, he was a very approachable person. A person who, during his last days, was calling for peace to be maintained, and a gentleman, an officer and a gentleman. I don't know how to describe him, but he was, to describe him further, otherwise, other than the words I've expressed.
And when Chris Hani was murdered, I assume it must have been quite a difficult time for you, losing not only one of the most revolutionary leaders South Africa's produced, but also a friend.
Yes, not necessarily a friend, but the truth of the matter is that we were all shocked. I remember this day, President Mandela requested me to go and represent him in Swaziland. A brother to the current king called Nathi was getting married. And then I went there, flew there in the early hours, took a jet, And then when I came back, landed at Mthatha Airport at around 7 o'clock in the evening. I saw another jet parked outside in front of the airport building. And then the Madiba security said to me when I was landing there, please, Madiba, I would like to see you in the VIP lounge. I said, where is he going to? Why is he here? I left him in his house. Is he not going to enjoy his Easter weekend? Yeah. They kept quiet. So they just escorted me to see Madiba and then asked Madiba jokingly, Daddy, where are you heading to? And you're supposed to relax over this weekend, Easter weekend. Well, Bantu, your friend is no more. I said, who's that? And then he said, Chris Ani has been assassinated.
Mm.
And then I said, no, man, that's unbelievable. And then he started to narrate the story.
Mm.
And then he said, we must accompany him to Johannesburg. So the jet I used then took off and it left for Joburg, and then we boarded his jet, which was arranged by the then governor of South Africa. What is it? She was a spokesperson that time of the ANC. And then we landed in Joburg at night, and then at Joe Slovo, Cyril Ramaphosa, and some other few officers met us at the airport. And then we had a short meeting, and then Madiba was going to address the nation at SABC. And that's how we received the news. And then the following day morning, I flew down first flight. And this is when I started to weep for the first time in my life. I don't know how many tissue papers I used, because now it was dawning in my mind that this fellow is no more.
Yeah.
And what are the implications? But thanks God, the appeal by Madiba was heeded by South Africans.
Mm.
Absolutely. So I think it's a really big thank you to, people like Madiba and to you for ensuring that we were still able to have a peaceful transition. So thank you so much, not only for that, but for taking the time to share the story with us. I think that's all the time we have, but thank you so much, General Misa. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Bye.
Greg, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. I think there's definite value in seeing the human side of some of these people we've portrayed as heroes.
Mm.
So that we as us and also other young people can see that they're not so different from some of these people who are now, really well renowned.
Well, I'm glad. I think often for me at least, political biographies or sporting biographies, the most interesting stuff for me isn't about their achievements and the list of accolades that we already know that someone has already earned, but about the stories behind all of those things and the character involved.
That's very important, because I think that the biggest problem that we have, especially on the African continent, and it's happening more and more so here in South Africa, is that we're creating a cult of personality around the individual.
Mm.
So what happens is that Kingsley is not a human being that, goes to the loo, showers, sleeps and eats and does all these very natural things.
Mm.
Kingsley is a god in the eyes of people. And then what ends up happening is that Kingsley and the organization that he's linked to cannot be faulted. And that there is a very dangerous thing.
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up, Cashwell. Just quickly, on a very different note, we will be giving away some goodies. We're having a Cliff Central and WeChat competition. Cliff Central is turning one this month. And to celebrate, we'll be giving away 500,000 rands worth of smartphones. Yeah, Cashwell's now interested.
Yeah, he's pulled out his phone.
He's like, okay, how do I win? And you can win just by listening in and waiting for the question. Not Cashwell, can it? Okay, guys, let me get through this. You can win a smartphone. Just submit your answer on WeChat to the question I'll be asking and we'll be asking throughout the day. So if you want an upgrade or just need a new smartphone, we can hook you up. And our question during this hour is, how many hours is Kelman on Cliff Central? I'll repeat. The question is, how many hours is Kelman on Cliff Central? So please submit your answers to WeChat and you could win an S4.
All right.
Gashwal's awesome. Already on his phone. He's, you know, he's WeChatting right away.
And remember, you can call in on 0861-555-189 and you can reach us on Twitter at cliffcentral.com or directly to me at Mzanzi Masai. Okay, there we go. Now I've got to pay the bills, guys.
Awesome. Yeah. That's a brilliant one. Kingsley giving away smartphones.
I don't even have a smartphone. I'm giving away smartphones.
But guys, I want his own generosity.
I know, he's a wonderful guy.
I want to talk about something that happened on the weekend. Now, Greg, you were at this. So on Sunday, Helen Ziller, the head of the DA, announced that
could have been all sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, you were in a lot of places over the weekend, that's for sure. And she announced that she would not be running for re-election at the head of the party. Of the head of the party now. And I mean, Greg, you were at the press conference. I mean, what was the mood like there? Were people surprised? Was it like a clear united front? Were people sad? What was the mood at the press?
Can I add one more question to that? Because something I found absolutely fascinating. Okay. It was at OR Tambo International. Was this sort of something pre-planned, or did she just call people up like Greg that she knows and like, Greg, I'm here at OR? You know, I need to say something.
No, I think the meeting was at OR Tambo because they called sort of an emergency meeting of their federal executive committee from, so people came from across the country. Often they Skype in or like have video sort of calls in, I think. And this one, I think they just called it so everyone could arrive and go straight from the airport to the meeting. But the mood on Sunday, it actually started out with us. So they called this press conference for 11:30. There was a decent sized contingent from the media who arrived just a little bit before that. And we ended up waiting till I think almost 1 o'clock, which is extremely unusual for a Democratic Alliance press conference. And of course, in that time, I think what I enjoyed most was just the speculative tweets in that time beforehand, you know. The tweets talking about, is the DA going to announce that they're taking the three suspended economic freedom fighters or expelled economic freedom fighters into the party? So someone tweeted that they're disbanding the DA is disbanding their armed wing. ADT.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
So that's how it started out. And so eventually, and actually you could tell it was a tense meeting because initially we were standing maybe 10 meters sort of in the hallway away from where the meeting was taking place. And at some point, one of the media liaisons from the party came and told us, no guys, go and wait downstairs by the bar sort of pool area, which, you know, being journalists, we didn't mind too much.
Yeah.
But clearly it was a tense meeting. And there was no information coming out from that meeting at all. Didn't beforehand, none of those, the DA members inside let anything slip. But when we eventually got into the meeting at around about 1 o'clock, I found it quite odd because a lot of these DA members who we see quite regularly, all of a sudden seemed very tense or tired or any of the sort of bloodshot eyes and just thinking, what the hell happened in here, you know? And so Helen Ziller quite quickly, announced that she wouldn't be available for re-election to the leadership of the Democratic Alliance position, and it was hard to say. All of the other leaders of the DA, so people like Musi Maimane and John Moody and so on, were very surprised. They said they'd only heard about it that day that she wasn't going to run for re-election, and I think there was quite a spirited debate within that federal executive meeting, some people supporting in her decision, some people arguing that she should stay on, and sorry, I'm just getting signals from Kings in the studio, but yeah. But so I think the announcement was one really that hit the DA leaders with shock, a lot of them. Because now they're just going into a complete new era of what does this mean for the party. Helen Ziller has taken the party, I think, from, 16-point-something% of the national election in 2009 to over 22% in 2014. She's also helped transform the party and its racial look. They've made dents into that idea that the Democratic Alliance is only a party for whites or only a party for the wealthy. And she's also raised through a whole sort of class of new young leaders.
Absolutely. I mean, based on that, I mean, I've been quite interested as to what legacy you think she'll leave behind. Are we going to remember the person who did that much for opposition politics in the country and held the ruling party to account? Are we going to remember the more brash side? She's often, you know, getting into arguments on Twitter and she's had some spats with journalists. So how do you think that's big enough to actually affect her legacy, or are we really going to remember what she actually did for the country?
With all due respect, look, Helen Zille has not been the kindest person in the last year or so. Mm. Let's be honest. She has. I mean, I saw her spat with Eusebius Mukhaiza via Twitter, which I thought was a bit childish on both their sides. But the fact of the matter is that Helen Zille, yes, has been extremely acrimonious with the media.
Absolutely.
And, you know, she hasn't been the most comfortable person to be around. But I think that, again, going back to what we just spoke about the humanity of a leader,
yeah,
we shouldn't detract from the fact that this woman has grown this party and has turned the DA not only into just an opposition party, but a legitimate government in the Western Cape. A government that is challenging the current ANC and making people think that, but wait, hang on, isn't that what governance is supposed to look like? At least, whether rightly or wrongly, but yeah, that question is being asked. Whereas under Tony Leon, who was a predecessor,
yeah,
it was oppositionist politics. You know, under Thabo Mbeki, it was commonly said then that Tony Leon knew what he did not stand for as opposed to what he stood for. Whereas Helen Zille transformed that largely. Apart from that, she grew the party, as Greg just highlighted there. And then these are that's really the legacy that she's leaving behind. And I think for especially politicians in the political scene, I know Inkatha Freedom Party was asked, what do you guys think about this transformation that she, you know, this transition that the DA is going through? And their response was, well, we don't comment on other political parties. Of course you wouldn't. You have had the same leader for the last how long?
Yeah,
so you wouldn't necessarily.
They don't want to get into that.
You know, you and it's not nice to say, guys, we don't believe in this democracy stuff. You know.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that for me, I think that's really a contribution.
Absolutely, guys. We're just gonna have to quickly go to a break. I'm sorry, and we'll be back just after this commercial.
Hi, Dave from A1 Builders in Pretoria.
Yeah.
It's Dan. I found your number on the internet, and I need you to build me a room, the purpose of which I cannot disclose.
What?
Fine. It's a sunroom. Can you start immediately?
It's 4 a.m.
I'm sure it's 4 a.m. somewhere, Dave, but here in SA, it's 10.
You mean USA?
There's more than one Pretoria out there. For the quickest and most efficient way to find what you're looking for, start your search with yellowpages.co.za or download the app. Yellow Pages. For local, reliable results.
It has been locked away from the eyes of the world. Chained, never to be released. But now, it wants to get out. Stay tuned to Cliff Central weekdays to find out how you can unleash the Jeep Renegade. Find hidden codes and videos posted by Jeep SA, and you could win Jeep Renegade prizes, as well as become the person to single-handedly unleash the Jeep Renegade upon the shores of South Africa. Are you renegade enough? Visit unleashrenegade.co.za to find out. T's and C's apply.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, we are giving away Samsung S4 Galaxies throughout the show. Cliff Central is turning one, and to celebrate, we're giving away R500,000 worth of smartphones. You can win just by listening in and answering the question. The question during this hour is, how many hours is Kelman on Cliff Central? That is, how many hours is Kelman on Cliff Central? You can You can give your answer through WeChat, and you could be selected as one of the lucky winners. Just quickly to Mike Adewa, please submit your response through WeChat and not Twitter. And the question is, how many hours is Kelman on Cliff Central? There we go. Greg, I cut you off just before we went to the commercial break. We were discussing Helen Zille's decision that she will not be running for re-election at the DA. And you had something to say about that.
I think obviously we're looking at her legacy right now. And we will, obviously, taking into account all of those different aspects. So she often has quite a caustic sort of attitude to other sort of people. And it rubs a lot of people the wrong way, including me. You know, often it's hard to... It's hard to feel like she's not that sort of leader that you feel like you like,
yeah,
but you respect her often for what she does. But it might even be, obviously, we will be talking about her legacy as leader of the Democratic Alliance, but it's not like she's going away.
Yeah.
So she's not running for re-election as leader of the DA, but she will serve out her term as Western Cape Premier, and that term lasts until 2019. So we're going to have her around for quite a while yet, and yeah, I'd imagine she will be. It'll be interesting to see how much involved she is in the new DA leadership and the trajectory of the party after she's no longer.
I mean,
in
that's
leadership.
That's my big question. Can she actually step out of being the one who's in charge? Is she still going to be the puppet master?
Especially while she still wields a very influential position, if not the most influential position for the party.
For sure. Anyone going to Harvard at the press conference? Any such announcements?
No big announcements.
We thought someone might be coming back from Harvard, but that's one of the other things about the timing of Zilla's announcement. Mm. It really does make it hard for other leaders, except for Musim Imani. There are other leaders, of course, in the DA. But if you want to look at whether Lindiwe Mozabuko might have contested the leadership of the party or not, this announcement, the timing, makes it extremely difficult because Lindiwe Mozabuko hasn't finished her studies at Harvard yet. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, and she can't really just in a few weeks, I guess, decide to quit Harvard and come back and lead the DA. I think that's too soon. And on the other hand, Musim Imani is almost in this constant state of election where he's just traveling around to different communities. He's always on TV in Parliament. He's always speaking, responding to President Zuma and the ANC on the biggest issues in the country. So Musim Imani is primed to win this election if he goes for it, just because he's always there. He's always campaigning.
If there's someone that has had a very impressive meteoric rise throughout his political career, it's Musim Imani. I mean, I was very lucky to be able to interview the guy and have a chat with him.
Oh, yeah, tell us about it.
And what I found very interesting about him is he started off in the ANC Youth League, right? Brimstone and fire and all of that. And, you know, very revolutionary. But there was something within the ANC that he just didn't like anymore. So then he gave the DA a shot, and that's where we've seen this guy just rise. I mean, he went from being spokesperson of the DA to being the Gauteng premier candidate for the DA to now being the parliamentary leader for the DA and possibly being the party's leader. And all of this in about 2 to 3 years. I mean, 3 years, I think, of being very conservative. I mean, I think this guy's just been... Yeah.
I think Musi's meteoric rise has, number one, been because he is a very, very impressive individual.
Absolutely.
Number two, though, he's been backed by many people who've pushed him along the way, looking for, as the DA has done with a number of leaders, looking for a credible, young, legitimate black voice in the party. The question is, along that way, does he have a significant support base? Who he can rally around in times of to keep the party together?
Do you mean inside the party or you mean regular citizens?
I mean inside the party, to be able to keep the party together when you know, in politics, the thing is it's not about winning elections. It's often just about managing your own party. And that's the question as well. Does Musim Imani have the experience to help grow the DA at branch level, to help build the party and increase the number of members it has and get those members out in volunteer campaigns when the elections come around? And I think one of the other concerns about Musim Imani, although he is likely to be leader, is Musim Imani has shown an extreme ability to adapt to the situations he's in. The best example of that is when we saw him come to Parliament after the last elections as Democratic Alliance and opposition leader in Parliament. Musim Imani got there, and I think he was still sort of focusing on his little, well, people criticize and say the little Obama sort of type speeches. But in there, he was all of a sudden competing with these very experienced ANC MPs, and then also Julius Malema, who can win a crowd. He can win headlines no matter what he does.
And has been doing that for a long time.
He knows how he does that. And so Musim Imani, sort of in comparison, didn't look like the leader of the opposition. It was Julius who looked like the leader of the opposition. And what we saw Imani do is sort of adopt a stronger approach to the ANC and the EFF. And all of a sudden, he stepped up and started taking stronger opinions, started delivering his lines much harder. And I think we saw that flexibility there. But then... it's one of those things that we have to wonder if Musim Imani has come into his own stride yet. Has he found his own character? And is he ready to lead the party? And is he comfortable in his own position and shoes when he's had such a meteoric rise in only 4 years now from mayoral candidate to a potential party leader candidate?
Absolutely. I mean, I think is it realistic to expect somebody other than Musim Imani to end up feeling Helen Zilla's shoes?
I mean, right now with the candidacy, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, people that have announced and said that they are actually in for the race. I mean, the only other significant name within the DA, I don't know, is she still leader of the Independent Democrats, or is she actually officially, is the ID now part of the DA, is Patricia de Lille. All the other big names have said no, you know, including Lindiwe Mazibuko, who was obviously the very first person ever. I mean, with Helen out of the way, we know that things were acrimonious between the two of them towards the end, hence the sudden... scholarship, at least that's what people say. But the fact of the matter is that Musi seems to be primed to take. Is he inheriting a poison chalice? Well, that's the interesting question that I'm thinking of now. I mean, listening to what you had to say there, Greg.
Hmm. I think in terms of what are the other options for leaders? Who were those two guys?
I've got this bizarre moment
in the press conference when Helen Ziller said, no, there have been two nominations submitted, but no one knows who they are.
Jack Swart and Neil Elf.
And so when she actually finally found those names in the press conference, all of the DA leaders and all of the journalists just had one of those moments when they looked at each other and everyone sort of shrugged their shoulders, like, who the hell is that?
Is it you? People are just like, is that you, Jack?
That's right. So, and obviously there was that 17, 18-year-old kid who...
I love him, but you told me, Greg told me that he pulled out. I was so excited. I thought
he was there. He pulled out.
Apparently he's pulled out soon.
Helen Ziller met with the matric students and I think he was satisfied that his concerns that the party wasn't following its liberal roots, he was satisfied that Ziller and the DA were addressing those concerns. And so there was that moment when no one knew who these guys were, right? And so obviously that was the key thing after Ziller announces it. It's easy for us to talk about Ziller's legacy and you know, will we remember her as you know, this person who trolls random people on Twitter?
Or a legitimate politician who did great things for not only her party, but I dare say for the country.
That's right. Yeah. But the harder thing is to say who will actually lead the opposition and who will take the opposition into next year's elections when there are some key municipalities up for grabs. And seriously, up for it could change hands in terms of who governs them, and so I think that's what all the DA leaders started thinking about. And Musi Maimwani was the obvious sort of guy that everyone starts looking to. And we asked him a few times in the press conference, "Will you be nominated and will you stand for election?" And he said, you know, very sort of diplomatically, "It's Helen's day. I have to assess the situation. I have to speak to the party and my family." But still, I think...
He hasn't made an announcement yet, has he?
No, he hasn't made any sort of announcement. He hasn't even really hinted as to... except that he hasn't ruled himself out, and that's the key thing. Then Patricia de Lille, who I think would come with the experience, she would... I don't know if she's the sort of fire that the DA needs as a leader, but she could definitely go for the position, but she's focusing on taking the Western Cape Democratic Alliance leadership this weekend, where she's up for nomination at their Congress, and I think she'll be focusing mainly on that. Then the only other person that I think hasn't completely ruled himself out might be John Moody, the Gauteng Democratic Alliance leader.
Okay.
Who, you know, he could give it a shot, and he's also allied with Makhushule Ghana, who's going for the federal chairperson position.
Yeah, because what I find interesting is whenever you say about anyone,
it's not a good start.
Yeah. Well, I'm not putting my money on that.
The hard thing is with the DA. Let's be honest, they need a black leader. So that immediately does cut a whole lot of the leadership out. Mm-hmm. You know, because they've got a number of very experienced white male politicians with a large support base within the party, but the face of the party just has to transform. It just has to. And if they were to elect another white leader, the ANC would have a field day. They would just say, continually, they're trying to transform, and then you've got this guy, Musi Maimwani, guys like Lindiwe Mazabuko.
Good, but not good enough.
Guys like Mbali Ntuli, Mashule Ghana, but all they are is your puppets. That's exactly what the ANC would say.
Yeah.
And one of the key ambitions, I think, of the Democratic Alliance under Helen Ziller has been transforming the idea that the DA will bring apartheid back, that it is a white party. And I think if it's just simply to elect another white leader, which, you know, it's a democratic process for their elections, so they can do it, but if they were to do it, I don't think that would play well in the next elections.
Absolutely. I think my final question on this, I mean, the idea is for the head of the party to eventually contest the presidency with the intention of winning the presidency. Now, should Musi Maimwani be elected the head of the party, from my perspective, he doesn't seem to have a constituency. I mean, Jacob Zuma is very strong in KZN, as we've seen. Helen Ziller in the Western Cape. Does Musi Maimwani have a group of people, or some kind of group of citizens somewhere in the country that he can point to and say, these people back me and this is my stronghold?
I don't think it does specifically, but to win the presidency, it's only the party that needs to get the majority of seats in parliament. And the question is, does the DA have significant support throughout the country. And I don't think, obviously in the Western Cape, the DA has a huge supporter base that's done very well, growing from in the last two elections, that's grown. I don't think Musi, he's from Soweto, I guess. So I think if we want to stretch at something, what could be his constituency, which, you know, is it, doesn't mean people are going to rally around him, but it's that sort of black,
I think
it's that sort of young black middle class and the other perhaps races or transformations who might be looking for transformation, willing to support a black leader, but they don't want to support the ANC because they might disagree with the idea of corruption, with Zuma's governments, even with issues like BEE, you know.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. Remember, you are tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You can call in on 0861-555-189, and you can reach us on Twitter at cliffcentral.com or directly at Mzanzi Masai. We are having a competition during the show and during the whole month of April. Cliff Central is turning one, and to celebrate, we're giving away R500,000 worth of smartphones, and you can win just by listening out for the question and submitting your answer via WeChat. If you want to upgrade your phone, or your phone broke or forever fell in the toilet or something like that, we'll hook you up. You got the Samsung Galaxy S4 directly from Cliff Central, courtesy of our birthday turning one. The question for this hour is, how many hours is the Kelman Show on Cliff Central? So please go through the WeChat and you can reach us there. Next, we'll be talking about xenophobic violence in the country. I mean, Greg, I know this is something that you've been looking at. I mean, it seems to be taken quite seriously. I mean, the president has assigned some ministers to this. You informed me that they're having an emergency meeting to discuss what's going on. I mean, but Greg, just give us the update. What's going on down in Durban?
Actually, right now, I think it's a rather a depressing moment for me because I'm watching News 20. I'm just on my computer here. Yeah. I've got News 24 up, and I think for the first time ever, there's a live blog focusing. First time I've ever seen something like this.
Yeah.
A live blog saying police in standoff with 2,000 people in Durban CBD. Jeez. where locals are trying to attack and loot stores owned by Pakistani nationals. And this thing has just gone unabated almost for the last 2-3 weeks, I think it was. It's been since... So let's go back to the start. Yeah. First of all, this year we had xenophobic violence in Gauteng.
You covered that quite closely.
Yeah. I covered that a lot. It started in Soweto in Snake Park, where a little incident between a Somali store owner and a young boy who was on Yope turned into a huge thing and protesting and looting across Snake Park, which eventually led to the death of a 14-year-old local boy who was killed as people tried to loot. I think it was a Pakistani-owned store in Snake Park. That spread, that went crazy for a while, you know, it lasted for a while, and it really displaced a whole lot of people, left a number of people injured and displaced, and many displaced, a few dead, many injured. So then that died down. Then I think, when was it, late last month, when Zulu King, Goodwill Zwelithini, said in a speech that, and let me just sort of paraphrase here, but foreigners must go. For the reasons that they're, I think, taking our jobs and damaging our culture. In the next, I think, few days or in the next week, there was an industrial dispute at a factory around Durban. And I can't remember the details of this, but I think there were some guys getting fired or some guys who didn't get their right jobs or something like that. And they blamed foreigners for their situation when they quoted the king's comments.
Oh, and here I thought we misunderstood the king. No, because, I mean, there was the retort.
He did say in that retort. But from what I've seen in terms of that, the media reusing his audio and what he said, the media seemed very confident that he was not misquoted.
The point that I'm just making is that here you have ordinary people on the ground saying exactly what he said.
Yeah, they're quoting him.
But he said that, no, we got it wrong. You know, it's lost in translation because people like Greg and Gersh can't speak Zulu, therefore we'd obviously get it wrong, which is absolute, you know.
They could, I guess, say, he could say that the media took what I said and then spread it to the people, and then they're quoting me from the media. But even, I think it was the Zulu media, I think, that led with this stuff. It wasn't the English speaking press that I think launched this. But so that happened, this sort of small industrial dispute, and from there it's just spread. It spread to a number of townships and the CBD of Durban. And
yeah,
I mean, we've seen
four
people.
I hardly know what to say.
We've seen four people killed already. I mean, there's a lot more than that that's unconfirmed, so we might see that death toll rise. I mean, I think the question is, I mean, what happens now? I think I dare say senior leaders in the country, their strategy so far seems to have been to downplay what was happening, at least in Gauteng, and say this is criminal elements, not xenophobia, and try to maybe just tone it down and not to create panic. That's clearly not a viable strategy anymore, because, I mean, here we are, all right? Four people have been killed. This is happening. I mean, so
I think this, I for the life of me, don't understand what the justification was that the police came out and said it's criminal elements as opposed to using the big X word.
Yeah.
It's xenophobia, simple as that. And with all due respect to analysts and really smart people that will tell me it's Afrophobia, Pakistani nationals don't come from the African continent. This is xenophobia. So in other words, the qualification literally boils down to, are you from this country or not? That's it. And then if you're not from this country, you're going to find yourself foul of an angry crowd. And just this morning, I had this very same conversation. Mm. And, you know, on my radio show. And I got very upset. Because for the last 4 years, I've been hearing the same rubbish over and over. The same nonsense coming out. And I think that to a large extent, as South Africans as well, in as much as I do blame people like King Gudul Zwelithini for saying really dumb stuff. Mm. Because it is dangerous as a leader. For someone that has access, direct access. You know what? He's probably WhatsApp friends with President Jacob Zuma. If you have a concern with the number of foreigners that we have in the country, then say, hey, you know, JZ,
what's going
mark
on?
A plan, make a plan. You know what I mean?
As a traditional authority and a leader of you know, the Zulu nation and the Zulu kingdom, he has access, he's part of government and has access to government policy.
Yeah, legitimate channels, absolutely. Yeah.
So he has the opportunity to say, I don't know, tighten up the borders, do something about the situation.
Or just raise it at the next meeting and be like, what do we do about that?
Rather than blaming it by saying those things at a public rally.
Exactly. And then when you have situations where people are dying, then maybe it is time that the government and that the leaders start taking responsibility for this.
I think if we just want to quickly update on the government's position on this, it seems like they're finally taking things seriously. Home Affairs Minister Melissa Gigaba has said that political, traditional and religious leaders should refrain from making comments that would lead to people being killed. It's even sad that we have to have someone saying, don't say things that's going to get people killed.
Yes.
But Melissa Gigaba has at least stepped up and said that. The Zulu King didn't seem very happy about it. But he said that. And then this morning there's been a briefing by the Justice and Security Cluster briefing, the ministers there, who have said that they're going to send more police and they're going to take appropriate action for these groups. They're working with some of the other diplomats from countries like Somalia and Malawi, who have expressed concern and may even offer to bring their citizens back and repatriate them to their countries. And they seem to have at least finally gotten over this thing as to being caught up on, is it xenophobia or is it criminality? But I think it was the police minister who said, foreigners are being targeted.
Yeah.
That's a sign of what it is. And that's what we need to focus on. Mm. You know, that says something. So, and we need to put an end to it right now. But following from this live blog that we have going on right now, it doesn't look like this thing's ending.
I mean, I think, just in conclusion, I worry about the idea of Malawi and Somalian government saying, you know what, we're going to try and repatriate our people. Because for me, that quote unquote rewards the behavior.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. We don't want these people here. We attack them, we burn their shops, and then they left. Mm. So, for me, that's like, this works.
So the end goal, what we wanted in the first place has been achieved, even though it was done through diplomatic means, but that's exactly what we wanted.
I mean, so I think that's maybe something small that I worry about.
And what does that say as about South Africa as a government as a nation, that these other countries have to come in and save their citizens because they're not safe here?
Absolutely. Just a quick reminder, you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We talked a bit about Chris Hani's legacy and the DA post Helen Ziller, and briefly about the xenophobic attacks that we've been seeing happening in Durban. Now quickly we're going to switch and go international. I mean, I was on Facebook the other day, and I stumbled upon the Hillary Clinton announcement video, and I quite liked it. I don't know, is that something that you guys have seen?
Great. Yeah, I was quite moved. But I'm a sucker, but I don't have a TV.
It was the dog. I think you saw the dog. And it was
I think when I see any sort of emotional adverts, I'm a sucker for it. I'll buy that financial services. I'll vote for that presidential campaign.
I haven't seen the video yet, but I'm very impressed by it. I've seen snippets of it.
Yeah,
very well done, pulling at the heartstrings. I mean, if you can get Greg to shed a tear silently. by himself. Yeah, it worked.
I mean, it seemed focused on families, and it was just like, I think it was a group of families, and one is like, oh, we're focusing on our daughter, we are focusing on school, we're focusing on this, and it seems maybe she might be going for a sort of family-based sort of middle class.
Seems like very middle class family with sort of average ambitions that everybody can relate to.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard, and we'll have Jay Brooks Spector on the line from the Daily Maverick pretty soon to actually tell us more about this. But I'm hearing rumblings that we're going to have a third Bush who will be running for president.
Yeah!
And there we go. It's about time! Okay, we're seeing a side of Gushel we've never seen before. But I can't imagine America voting in a third Bush in the president.
You know what's an interesting thing? I'll just quickly throw this out there. What I found interesting was that Mitt Romney, everyone made a big deal about Mitt Romney running up against Obama. Yeah. Mitt Romney was the sacrificial lamb. Because at the time, and this was my question, where's Jeb Bush? Where is the third Bush? The reason why he wasn't put up is because the Republicans took the very calculated risk and understood the chances are Obama was going to return to office anyway.
It's tough. The incumbent one is pretty tough.
Yeah, so let's hui Mitt out there and say, we'll give you another opportunity. And then Jeb Bush obviously was kept safe. He remained governor of Florida, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm looking forward to a third Bush. I mean, this is a nice fantasy, you know. We'll smoke him out, you know. We need someone tough to fight asses.
Okay. So we're gonna bring this back.
Do we have Brooks on the line?
We don't have Brooks just yet. But in the meanwhile, I think
someone brings some sanity to this conversation. I think my question is just gonna have to continue in this.
I dare say. I think it's generally accepted that Bill Clinton had a pretty successful term in
office. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Mm. Some stumbles along the way, but I think it's accepted. It's accepted. So I mean, how much does that come into play? Can we expect to see him being really, really involved during the running? I mean, what do you think? Or do you think he'll be focused on Hillary, or will he really be exactly where she is?
I haven't been following his campaign so closely, but I think one of the things is that they're going to sort of try to make sure that Bill Clinton in his campaign, because he wields a huge amount of weight. Yeah. Anything he sort of does and says gets attention, and he can really rally a lot of support around his wife. But when Hillary Clinton was running in the Democratic nominations for president, what year was that now? 2007, something like that. Mm.
Yeah.
So Bill Clinton, I think, went a little bit off script sometimes then, and I don't think he really did he didn't really do Hillary justice on occasion. So I think now they're going to try and rein him in and make sure that he's really always following the campaign line.
Yeah, but I mean, in all seriousness, I think that Hillary does stand a very good chance this time around. You know, I mean, she went up against Obama, who had a very, very smart campaign.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing is whisperings are that the guy that helped out with Obama's social media campaign is part of the Hillary Clinton team.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I think we see the video the nature of the video. You can already see it's pulling at the heartstrings. It's dealing with day-to-day issues that you and I are worried about, the bread and butter issues. Not sort of that's the biggest problem the Republicans, I think, face right now, is that the Republican Party is seen as a party, more and more seen as a party for the 1%. And, you know, the Democrats are really using that very well to say that it's the average American, the day-to-day guy, the one that has to pay water and light bills and, you know, has to wake up and go to an average job.
Yeah.
Those are the people that they're trying to appeal to, and she's going to do that very well. I mean, you know, jokes aside about Jeb Bush, I honestly think that the Republicans will have to come out with big guns to be able to dominate the media space and the sentiment space.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm going to miss Obama. Maybe it's because I'm Kenyan and I'm a bit biased in that aspect. But I'm going to miss. I think some of it is just going to be the pride that it was.
Nepotism.
It was seeing somebody who was being labeled as all sorts of things, man. You know, being called an Islamic terrorist, being called, you know, Kenyan and whatever, and seeing all that slung at him, and he still won, and he's still, you know, he's there, you know, and the country still standing, the country still surviving. He inherited a pretty tough economic climate and a pretty tough global climate, and he managed to navigate it. And whether he was successful or not, you know, that's up to whoever to say. But fact is, you know, he's not leaving the country worse off than he found it, and I think that's worth saying.
And he certainly had the courage to take bold steps where other leaders haven't before.
Absolutely.
This week's shown that how when it came out that he met with Raul Castro.
Yeah.
As well as talking about soon lifting the sanctions on Cuba and working through some of these things, as well as pushing health care and a whole number of things, he actually has confronted a whole lot of things that other people haven't been brave enough to do before.
I mean, we've seen a lot of legalization of gay marriage. We've seen him really push immigration and trying to move away from illegal immigrants who are children and so on being back deported to their home countries. And I think you're right. He wasn't afraid. And I think we see this often with second term presidents. When it's the second term, it's like, okay, now, you know, it's no nonsense now. These are the things that are important to me, and these are the things I'm going to push.
But I mean, Hillary has one major issue that she has to deal with at the moment. This is the email scandal. When I saw the tweets the first time,
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Yeah. What I found very interesting about that is obviously now the Benghazi attacks, which has been
give us some context.
It's basically her biggest political scandal, you know, and what has turned out was that she was using her personal emails for that. The Republicans are saying that there's no email trail left of it because she's deleted
some of her emails, and that was during the time when some American sort of government officials were killed
in Benghazi. Now the issue, the real issue with that is again just showing what is sort of the poverty within the Republican Party at the moment, because you're not coming up with a candidate that says, you're not just talking absolute nonsense and these are the policies that's going to fail this country. Instead, you're going for the personal attack. And that's why I think, really, I think it would be a good thing for the U.S. if Hillary Clinton had to become president.
Especially, I think it would be extremely symbolic having the first female president. I think that would really make waves for women across the world.
Absolutely.
But guys, the one thing we shouldn't discount is that she is actually someone that has experience in the White House.
Of course.
Absolutely. I mean, Secretary of State, I mean, she was Senator of New York, so I think she's got a very serious sort of political experience that she's coming into office with. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for tuning into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Please remember you can listen into the podcast, and you can always continue to tweet us during the week between now and the next show. We will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
CliffCentral.com.